So we're up to Perek Chafalef and Pasuk Yud Zayin 21:17. And the Pasuk says, Ish Machsor Ohev Simcha. Again, the Hebrew is kind of the opposite of the syntax of the English. The English translation is, he who loves a good time will be a man whose assets are depleted. Meaning to say, if you like to party, you will not have a good retirement account. That's the simple meaning. And therefore it says, Ohev Yayin V'shemen, he who loves wine and oil, you know, aromatic oil, Lo Ya'ashir, shall not become rich. Right? So the simple, again, it's a simple meaning. This is simply saying, you can either decide to save your wealth or to spend it. And if you spend it on physical pleasures, they're here today and gone tomorrow, and there's nothing that you take with you, either for your retirement or for Olam Haba, in terms of mitzvos and the like. Right, so that's the simple meaning of it. Now the Gra will also give us some deeper meanings, how it applies to spiritual growth. Ish machsor ohev simcha, a lover of joy will be a man of deprivation. He'll lose things. Okay. Hachaser mikol hu ohev simcha v'smoach tamid. Ohev yayin v'shemen lo yashir, ki eino roev parnasaso laharviach, he does not try to create long-term profit, elo rodef achar yayin v'shemen. Okay, in the short-term pleasures.
That's a little upset, because I like joy.
Well, joy is good, but I mean, joy as an attitude is a good thing, but we're talking about simcha as a hedonist.
But does this not contradict with the ezev ashir ha-sameach b'chilko?
Yeah, well, it does contradict. I mean, obviously, the use of simcha in this verse is not the same use of the term. Here, simcha means frivolity and just having a good time. But now he explains the following. Ho'inyan, the deeper meaning is, Ish machsor, a man who lacks things, is a man who lacks Torah learning. She'ein bo shum reyach Torah. He doesn't even have the aroma of Torah. There's not even a little bit of good smell of Torah that cleaves to him. Hu ohev lios tamid besimcha. Such a man always wants to have a good time. L'smoach b'schok. See, l'smoach b'schok haksilim. To rejoice with the playing around of the fool. Ki haTorah hu machkimas pesi. The Torah gives wisdom to the foolish. So if you're chaser Torah, you'll be a fool. Right? Torah is machkimat pesi. Now, ohev yayin is also a symbol for somebody who is rodef achar tavo sa'olam hazeh. Right? Wine is the prototype of the pleasures of this world. Lo yashir, he will not become wealthy, that means b'torah. In other words, he who loves the physical pleasures of the world will not become wealthy in Torah. Right? Now that's an interesting idea. Again, we've said over and over again that Judaism is not against enjoying the world, Judaism is not against pleasure. But if one loves pleasures too much, then they really will not love the Torah. Because to learn Torah, you have to deprive yourself of a certain measure of pleasure. All right. If a person would rather, you know, play games or watch TV or go to movies, then you're never going to, you know, learn Torah. And therefore, if you love possessions and pleasures too much, you will not have the wealth. Lo yashir, you will not have the wealth of Torah. And that's an important lesson, that one should not love anything. Actually, that's what they say. One should not love anything except, you know, Hashem and their family, you know, whatever, or other Jews or other people. One should never love things. What is the concept of loving a thing? How can you love a thing? In what way do you love a physical thing? Of course, there's an old story with that, that Rav Lev Chassman once saw a yeshiva bacher in yeshiva who was ravenously consuming a fish for lunch. So he says, why are you eating the fish so quickly? He says, I love fish. He says, you mean if you love something, you chew it up and spit out the bones? If you love the fish, you would put it back in the tank. He says, you don't really mean you love fish. You mean you love yourself. And you're using the fish as a tool of self-love. Now, Rav Chassman's point is that is sometimes what people mean when they say they love another person. They kind of chew them up. They use the other person for their self-gratification. But truly loving is selfless and altruistic. Truly loving a person is caring about their needs at least as much and even more, perhaps, than you care about your own. And that's what true love is. Okay, now he goes further, and he says, what is ish machsor, a man who is lacking things? Ho'inyin, ein machsor li'reyav. Right, we have a famous verse that we say in benching. Yiru es Hashem kedoshav, fear God, you holy ones, ki ein machsor li'reyav. There is nothing lacking to those who fear Hashem. So the Gra is making a nice verbal connection here. If the Mida of Yira means you have nothing lacking, then conversely we might say, Ish Machsor, a person who is lacking, means a person who does not have Yiras Hashem. Because if he would have Yirat Hashem, he would be, right, Lo Yachsor. Yira, now the attitude of reverence is the opposite of the frivolity of Simcha. Kamoshi Kasa Bezoar, Kesiv Ivduas Hashem Biyira, Uchsiv Ivduas Hashem Besimcha. There are actually two different verses, interestingly enough. One pasuk, which is more familiar to us, is Ivduas Hashem Besimcha, serve God with joy. There's another pasuk that says, Ivduas Hashem Biyira, serve God with fear, trepidation, awe, and reverence. So which is it? Do you serve God with joy, or do you serve God with reverence? Well, there's a third pasuk that actually combines the two that says, Gilu, rejoice, bira adah, with trembling. Those both verses are right. And it's hard for us to understand exactly what that means because we're used to kind of two ways of approaching Hashem's worship. One is joyous abandonment, you know, happiness, joy, and the other is deep reverence, which seems to be fearful and scared. But in reality, David HaMelech is telling us in Gilu Birada, and these two verses, Ivduas Hashem B'Simcha, Ivduas Hashem B'Yira, that somehow it is possible to have within your personality a sense of tremendous reverence and awe for the Almighty, and at the same time, an inexpressible joy at having the privilege of being close to Hashem. And these are the two ways of serving God, with love and with fear, and both of them coexist at the same time. They are not contradictory, but an ish machsor leaves out the yira and he only likes the joy, right? But he doesn't have the sense of yira. Ish machsor she'ein bo yira only has the simcha. Oev yayin v'shemen. Now, what's yayin v'shemen? Because we say the following: lechem hu halacha. Okay, he's using an interesting food analogy here. He says the basic halacha is called lechem and basar, bread and meat, staples. Wine and oil are delicacies. So that refers to the Haggadah, that refers to the philosophical, theological teachings. So the Gra has an interesting interpretation. Oev yayin v'shemen means the person who loves the Haggadah and the Medrash, but does not pay attention to the bread. Now, it's like saying, you know, if a person lives on spices, spices make food taste real good. But if you just eat the spices and you don't eat the food, you get no nutritional value. So what he's saying is, he who loves the beautiful, inspirational portions of Judaism, but does not root them in the details of halakhic observance, lo ya'ashir, shall not absorb the wealth of the Torah. This is an interesting point because, you know, there are many people that actually say, you know, Jews who, you know, they love. I remember many years ago, I was working with a person who wanted to convert to Judaism. It was a woman, and she was very, very erudite. She was a biblical scholar. She could, you know, read. She, as a non-Jew, she could read the whole Tanakh in its original, as well as the New Testament in Greek and Latin, you know, so she just very, very knowledgeable, you know, history, but she knew more about biblical history than I did. And, but the difficulty is, you know, she wasn't so able to keep mitzvahs, you know. She couldn't keep kosher because she was 100 miles from a kosher store. She couldn't keep Shabbos because of this reason. But she knew like 100 reasons why kashrus is beautiful. She says she knows the Rambam and the Rav Hillel. And she says, "Kashrus." So she appreciated all of the symbolism, all of the beauty, all of the philosophical reasons, but it did not translate into concretization of observance. And the Vilna Gaon says that's called a person who loves wine and oil but doesn't eat the bread. So such a person is not truly wealthy, because they have many, many ideas, but it does not translate into how they behave. Now, the opposite is also true. In other words, if a person just eats bread, that's a very bland diet, and ultimately it does not give a person emotional satisfaction. And that's why we also go into the philosophy of mitzvot and the like. But there needs to be that combination. So that's how he learns this. He says, lechem, bread, which is the staple of your diet, are the observance of the halachos. Yayin and shemen, which give taste, the wine and the oil, are agada. These are the philosophical and theological teachings.
About the Kabbalah? Yeah.
Well, that would include Kabbalah too. In other words, agada just basically means the inner meanings of external observances. V'haraitza lahalech bigdolos v'niflaos. If a person wants to deal with the high and elevated ideas, but he doesn't want to make the commitment for the nitty-gritty of everyday life, v'yeno roe l'kayim hadinim v'lilmod osam lo yashir, he shall not become wealthy. And now he brings in Pirkei Avos. Ki izeyo ashir, who is a wealthy person, hasameach b'chelko, he rejoices in the portion that God has given him. So you see what he's saying? In other words, God has given us mitzvos. So if I'm ashir, I'm sameach in God's mitzvos. If I don't want to do those mitzvos, I'm not an ashir. Actually, you have to be saying, I'm not literally sameach in the chelek that God has given me. And lechem, as it says in Borchi Nafshi, which is Psalm 104, levav enosh yisad, it supports your heart. It's like a support. Now this is a beautiful description. It is a foundation. The soul yearns to go upwards to God. So we're like a skyscraper seeking to get higher and higher and higher. But a building can only stand if there's a foundation for the building. The foundation is lechem. Lechem, levav enosh, yisad. Bread sustains. See, he's taking psukim that are literally referring to bread, and he's connecting this metaphorically. The bread sustains the heart of man. That means the halacha is the foundation that allows my heart and emotion to soar up to the Almighty.
So that's what he's connecting.
That's right, that's right. Very good, very good. Not by bread alone do you live, because you have to have the inner meanings as well. But it is the foundation. So it's not the building. This is actually an important idea, actually, because what is being suggested here is that keeping mitzvos is not the end all of being a Jew. It is the foundation of being a Jew. But if all you do are keep mitzvos and you don't try to think about the meanings and the purposes of them, so it's like you've dug a foundation without a house. So a house cannot stand without a foundation, but a foundation without a house also doesn't give you very much, right? So there is that combination. We find in the world people that go in one direction or the other. We have those who love the ideas of Judaism and not the practices, and then those who just do the practices without ever thinking about them. And both of them are missing an important point.
He's using here the word simcha.
Yes.
And in this three moadim we have the samachta bechagecha.
Yeah.
So how is the simcha of the moadim? How does it fit, you know, to
No, I agree with you that the use of the word simcha here for frivolity is actually not such a common use. Usually simcha refers to a deeper, more spiritual type of joy. In other words, usually simcha is a good thing to have. Here, it seems to be used negative. In a negative sense. Now, it's a good question. I mean, it seems to be inconsistent with a lot of the other usages. I mean, the answer is it's both. There's good simcha and bad simcha, but you would expect it perhaps a different word would be used.
The word for bad simcha is like hololut.
Hololut is a word. That's right. Yeah. Frivolity. That's right.
Be
that's
careful,
right.
But close to pulling.
Okay. You can come to the secrets of the Torah only by meticulous observance of the foundation. Don't think you can skip the mundane details, right, to get into Kabbalah, right? People want to go to Kabbalah right away. We have the Kabbalah Institute, or those Philip Berg's Institute, where Madonna and other people. Instant Kabbalah, instant enlightenment. He says, no, you cannot come to the Sodot.
Except I'm lucky I've less than 40 years, so I don't have, you know,
okay. 39, right? L'chein lo yashir. And therefore you will not get the wealth. Shlo yeklum, you will not have, you will not have anything. Okay. Yeah. In fact, it's been pointed out, you know, Gershon Scholem, who himself was not a religious man, but he was a great historian of Kabbalah. Somebody once said about Gershon Scholem, because they really, he was a person who really had studied all the works of the Kabbalists and the like, they said he was like an accountant. An accountant knows where all the wealth is, but he doesn't own any of it. Like, you know, let's say Bill Gates' accountant, you know, he knows the wealth, but it's not part of him. And but he does point out the following. He says that in most mystical movements, Christian mysticism, Eastern mysticism, there generally is a movement away from law, because the mystical experience in many ways is a contradiction to, you know, precise ritual, you might think. In other words, if the main point is closeness to God in an ecstatic union, then what's the difference if I make my Seder, you know, 15th of Nisan or the 16th or the 18th? And this is called, what's called, the fancy word for this is an antinomian. Antinomian just means against legalism. That mystical movements always have what is called a certain tendency towards anarchy or antinomianism, because they are, by definition, highly individualistic and private. He says Jewish mysticism is a very, very great exception, because the great Mekubalim actually read into the minutiae of halacha all sorts of secret meaning. So instead of saying the main thing is the emotional feeling, they actually saw in the details of the ritual how to connect connection with God. So in Jewish Kabbalah, there was never an antinomian idea. Rather, it was always connected to the details of the halacha. Okay. Let's look at Pasuk Yud Ches. Kofer Latzadik Rasha, V'tachas Yesharim Baygate. Now, literally, this means Kofer Latzadik Rasha, the Rasha is taken as ransom for the righteous, and instead of the upright, Bogade, the treacherous one. Now, what this seems to be saying, again, the problem is whether this is true as in life as we see it. What it seems to be saying is that if something bad is about to happen to a righteous man, right, so the image here is God will pull the righteous man away and put in the bad guy, right? The building's about to fall, God's going to make a switcheroo where it's going to fall on the bad guy. Therefore, the Rasha is taken as ransom for the righteous, and instead of the upright suffering, the bogey, the treacherous person. But we'll see. What can this mean? So he says, now you'll notice, though, again, there are two terms for righteous here in the parallelism of the verse. Tzadik, and then, which is singular, and then yisharim, which is plural. So he says the following. Tzadik v'yashar, the term tzadik, righteous, and yashar, which is upright, kavar kasavnu l'mala hevdelem, we've already talked about the difference, and he cites an earlier discussion, chapter 2, Perek Chaf. I don't remember that. Let's just see if we can see quickly what it is. This is Perek Beis, Pasuk Chaf. Tzadik versus Yashar. Okay, I see the definition of tzaddik. I don't know. Yeah, of course it doesn't say yashar in that pasuk. 1 second. I actually don't see any. Oh, yashar is the next pasuk. I see. Yesharim, balei haseichas, or balei tachtulas, the derech. Let's see here. So a tzaddik, he defines as oseh tzedakos v'noseh mishelo labriot. In other words, he does righteous things, and he gives of his own resources to help others, b'chinam, without any expectation of reward, af shelo haya roi, even though the recipients are not deserving. That is called a tzaddik. Right? You help people, even if in a sense they are not deserving of your help. Okay, that's what's called tzaddik. Yashar, he says in the next pasuk, actually, balei seichel. Balei seichel, balei tachpulos.
That's negative, balei tachpulos.
Well, yeah, but here it's used in a positive way. It seems to mean people who have a good moral sense. In other words, tzaddik refers more to your good heart. But a person with a good heart can be morally confused. Right? You see, in other words, what the Republicans like to call moral clarity, which they used to call moral clarity. But the notion of moral clarity is you kind of, you know, you pierce through all of the confusing values to see the right way. Because you can see, a person can have a very good and generous heart, but his moral intuitions may be very cloudy. So, for example, he might figure, I'll help this criminal, you know, evade the authorities, so to speak, because I have compassion. Or like Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech had compassion for Amalek, and therefore he didn't kill him, right? So it seems to me, that's what he means by Balei Seichel V'Tachpulot, means that a tzaddik is one with a good heart, and a yashar is one who sees the right way to proceed when there are conflicting values. It's kind of a clarity of vision. Now, going back to our verse here in 21:18, he says, the opposite of tzaddik and yashar is rasha and boged. So a rasha is a person, right? If a tzaddik is one who has good feelings towards others, the rasha has a hatred and an anger towards others. And if we say that a yashar is one that has a clarity of derech, a boged is a person who is morally confused, which is a little different than the standard translation. We often translate boged as someone who is treacherous. If I understand the Gra correctly, he basically is translating boged as someone who's morally confused because he cannot sort out the appropriate pathway when there are conflicting issues. Right, so that's the opposite. Okay, so now we go back to the pasuk. The Yamar, a rasha is kofer letzadik. The rasha is a ransom for the tzaddik. What does that mean? Bi'eis yugzar ala tzaddik eza ra'a. If it is decreed in heaven that something bad will happen to the tzaddik, harasha hu kafro, the rasha may take his place, shebo hagzeira ala rasha, vatzaddik lo yeda migzeiraso klal. Now, this is actually difficult because as far as I can see, usually the opposite seems to happen. I mean, basically, we talk about the death of the righteous can be a great atonement for many, many people. Like, God will take the righteous. Now, of course, the story of Haman, the story of Purim, is indeed one example where everything that was prepared to befall Mordechai,
basically Haman prepared.
It happened to Haman, so to speak. I mean, that's an example. But we see many, many examples, maybe more examples, the other way, in which things befall the righteous. But here he wants to say,
yeah. Is this not also a Christian idea? You know that Lehavdil, that Yeshu basically took on himself, you know, the...
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, the Christian idea that there's a certain degree of vicarious atonement was taken from Judaism.
It took a lot.
The concept that the death of the tzaddik is an atonement, I mean, so there is such an idea in Judaism. Now, the question is, what does that mean? Doesn't the Torah teach that each person must do their own tshuva? Each person is responsible for their own life. We normally don't say that one person can be an atonement for somebody else. I mean, the truth is there are many contradictions here. Some want to learn simply that when the death of a righteous person inspires me to realize the vacuum that was created, so in effect, it causes me to do tshuva. So it's not that the death of the righteous is an atonement. but the death of the righteous is an impetus and a catalyst for my own introspection and my own transformation. That's how someone wants to learn this. But here, the Gra is emphasizing the other idea, that sometimes God will take the Rasha as a replacement for the Tzaddik, and one Rasha will go instead of one Tzaddik. Now, what is Tachas Yesharim Boged? Kishikavar Nigzera Ra'a Lavo Ali Yesharim, and even if there's a decree against many Yesharim, God might take only one Boged. So what he's saying is the following. What he's saying is that since Yesharim are greater than Tzaddikim, right? Yesharim are greater than Tzaddikim, so God will allow the Gezerah against many Yesharim to be satisfied with only the loss of one person. In other words, what he's saying is that, in other words, that's what he's saying. The Rasha, one Rasha takes the place of one Tzaddik. But one Boged can take the place of many Yesharim. Because since Yesharim are greater than Tzaddikim, well, you think the opposite in a sense, but the argument is, since Yesharim are greater than Tzaddikim, so God is willing to satisfy the debt with relatively less punishment. So instead of destroying a lot, God destroys a little.
But it's this related to this thing here?
Yeah, that's right. We have the same language in davening. B'fi Yesharim, Divrei Tzadikim. Then there's Chasidim and Kedoshim. There are actually four levels there. Yeah, but here we're comparing Yesharim and Tzadikim. Okay, let's just do one more pasuk. Yeah.
Nishmat.
Now, once again, we have a lot of metaphors about the unpleasantness of living with a quarrelsome spouse. We talked about this earlier pasuk. Better to sit on the edge of a roof than to live with a quarrelsome wife. Well, here it gives a different example. Tov sheves b'yaretz midbar. Better to go to the deserts. Me'eshes midyanim. Than a wife of quarrel. Midyanim is...
Medanim has to be, not Midyanim. In Hebrew, no, this is Midyanim.
Yes.
In Hebrew, it's...
You're correct. Midyanim would be the normal word. But here the Kriya is Midyanim. It's unusual. Midyanim is normally a nation of Midyan. The Kas and anger. And here the Gra offers a very interesting explanation. Hayoshiv meshes Midyanim kol yomav kas machrobim. If you're with a quarrelsome wife, all of your days there is anger and pain. But now listen to this. Ha'inyan, Eishes Midyanim hu gufo. The quarrelsome wife are the demands of the body. There's your body. The body, the human body, is the quarrelsome wife that demands to be fed, to be clothed, to be taken care of, to be pampered, and the like. Uchsherodeif achar tavaso vekaso tamid. And if there are constantly demands of the body for more and more pleasure, it is better to move to the desert, to remove yourself from all of those temptations. That's how he interprets it. Better to live in the desert and break those temptations. Again, you know, we've remarked a number of times that the Gra in particular does have somewhat of a strong ascetic streak in the commentary to Mishlei, in which he does talk about deliberately breaking habits like eating excessively and accumulating money and the like, because he feels that, as we learned in the pasuk before, that this takes away a person's desire for learning. This also, in a sense, was consistent with the Lithuanian temperament. Remember that the Hasidic movement, which did emphasize more of the joy in the physicality of life, did not take root in Lithuania. Right? That's how we even have the expression. We have the expression in Yiddish, a kalta litvak. Kalta litvak means a cold Lithuanian car, because Litvaks, of course, the Gra was the epitome of the greatest of all, but all the Lithuanian Jews were known as very, very brilliant, analytical, non-emotional or unemotional people in some ways, and therefore the notion of kind of asceticism appealed to them because they found their great joy in learning Torah, not in the Hasidic gatherings and parties and things like that. So it is very different. The Polish personality and the Litvisha personality are actually very, very different personalities. Rav Soloveitchik is a Litvak, right? Litva. Although Rav Soloveitchik had a tutor, this is a whole interesting story. Rav Soloveitchik's is a Chabadnik. Yeah. Rav Soloveitchik's father was a Litvak. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's son was a Rav in a town that was largely Lubavitch. All right, that happens sometimes. So that's where you got your job. And when he hired a tutor for his son, this Lubavitcher tutor was supposed to teach his son Rav Yosher Ber. Gemara was teaching him Tanya and Likutei Torah, all of the writings. But anyway, when Rav Chaim, who was the Gadol Dor, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, came and he tested his grandson on Gemara, his grandson didn't know apparently as good as he should have known it. And Rav Chaim, you know, called in his son and says, "Get rid of that tutor. You have to get rid of him," you know, etc. However, it did have a fatal planted a fatal seed, because Rav Soloveitchik, all of his life, he had a great love for Tanya and Chassidus, although his personality was not that way. And there were times when in the summer he would give these massive mammoth shiurim in Boston. And he would often want to give a shiur in Likutei Torah, which is the Bala Tanya's Kabbalah Sefer. And like, you know, all the YU guys didn't, you know, weren't into it. And he couldn't get them to be interested. Rav Lichtenstein, who was Rav Soloveitchik's son-in-law, you know, used to beg him, don't do it. But he, you know, Rav Soloveitchik loved it. But the Talmidim did not absorb it. He absorbed from a real Lubavitcher. And he said it remained with him his whole life, the notion of the immanence of God. He said to a large extent, his sense that Hashem is a reality in the world is just a tangible reality, says he got from Chassidus. So this tutor was apparently a very extraordinary person in many ways. He really inspired him in ways that he did not get elsewhere. So it's interesting that you never know what can happen when a child is exposed to certain influences. Adin Steinsaltz, you know, his father was a communist, but his father was a very rational communist. He was an atheist, and he said, "I don't want to teach my son atheism. I want to expose my son to all the different beliefs, and then I know my son will make the rational decision that there is no God." And he was so convinced that this would be the decision that he hired the best Jewish teacher that he could to teach his son Chumash, Mishnah, and Gemara. And of course, things didn't turn out the way he was. And exposing his son to this teacher, you know, made Adin Steinsaltz religious, and then he became famous guy. And when Time magazine wrote an article with some hyperbole, but they wrote that Rabbi Steinsaltz, a lot of hyperbole, but they wrote that he was the greatest rabbi in 1,000 years. You know, that kind of insults Rashi and the Rambam a little bit, but, you know, but whatever it is. But they said he was the greatest rabbi in 1,000 years. So they quoted his father as saying, "They say my son is the greatest rabbi in 1,000 years, and I have to have a son that's the greatest rabbi." And it has to be me, you know. You know, but that's the idea, that you never know when you expose people to influences which way that's going to go. That's why when parents sometimes say they don't want to give their child a religious education, because they want the child to make his own decision. It's kind of a stupid thing. If you don't have the information, what decision are you going to make? Rabbi Steinsaltz's father was right. I mean, he was fair in that way. I just end with this little joke. It's Purim, so I can tell more stories. But they tell a story about a fellow in Minsk who wanted to be an apikoris. He was determined one day he was going to be an apikoris. And they told him, "If you want to be an apikoris, you have to talk to Yasala. Yasala is the chief apikoris of Minsk." So he says, "Where can I find Yasala?" He says, "Well, Yasala spends the day in the Beis HaMedrash." That already sounded a little odd. So he goes to the Beis HaMedrash, and he asks for Yasala. Yes, he sees a man with a long white beard who's sitting over a Gemara, and you know, he's learning very conscientiously. So he says, "Are you Yasala the Apikoris?" He says, "Yes, I'm the Apikoris of Minsk." So he says, "Well, I want to be an Apikoris. I don't believe in anything. I want to be an Apikoris like you." So he says, "Well, have you finished Shas? Have you finished the Talmud?" He says, "No, I haven't. I mean, I don't believe it." He says, "Have you learned Tanakh?" He says, "No." "Have you learned Mishnah?" "No." So Yesla says, "You're no Apikoris. You're only ignorant." He says, "To be an Apikoris, you know, you have to know." That's why people like, you know, people like the first generation Ben Gurion, you know, Ben Gurion is an Apikoris. You know, I mean, the guy knew some stuff. the new generation or b'chlal, they're not epicures. You know, they don't know anything whatsoever. You know, okay. Have a good quorum.